This weekend starts right after this.
Wix.com lets you easily create a beautiful professional website for free. With hundreds of stunning templates and an intuitive drag-and-drop website builder, you can get your business online today. No coding needed. Start now at Wix.com. That's Wix.com.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Corporate America High School Football. I'm Bruce Johnson, in for Gordon Deal, along with Jennifer Kashinka. Coming up this hour,
the global sports management giant IMG is also a giant in high school football. The company's prep school academy has one of the top teams in the nation.
A tech analyst says many of the front runners in the presidential campaigns are guilty of bad management skills.
College boxing clubs are rising from the canvas. We'll tell you why they're making a comeback.
And who's that with Pope Francis? We'll point out the people you're seeing in person and on TV in the papal entourage.
We found that there was basically a half dozen types of people with him to make his trip smooth and official. You have people who are involved in the papal household. These are the people that help run the papal residence at the Vatican. You also have the masters of ceremony. These are the folks in charge of anything to do with liturgy and public prayer.
That's Washington Post reporter Dan Zak, who will have more in about a half an hour. You probably heard of the global sports management conglomerate IMG, but did you know that IMG has a high school that features one of the top football teams in the nation? Here's Gordon Deal on the T-Mobile hotline.
We're speaking with Jeri Longman, New York Times sports writer. He's got a fascinating piece entitled High School Football, Inc. All right, so set this up, Jeri. Explain what you wrote about here with this this IMG program in Florida.
So IMG Academy in Bradenton, Florida, 45 miles south of Tampa, is in the third year of having a football program. It began decades ago as a tennis academy. It now has eight sports. They have football now for the third year, and they have six of the top 100 recruits in the country, including the top quarterback in the country, the top tight end, the national sprinting champion, the top cornerback in the country. As high school football has become more professionalized at the public, private, parochial, charter school level, this is the latest iteration of a kind of corporatism or increasing professionalism of high school sports. Mm. So they recruit kids from around the country. They have kids from 21 states and six countries. You know, they're very upfront about it's the about their profit motive. They're there to make money. It costs $70,800 a year to play, to go to school and board and play football. Although there is financial assistance available based on need, and some kids are paying nothing, but right, many are paying, you know, tens of thousands of dollars.
Clarify a point here, because I think it's an interesting one. IMG, as you said, they're for profit. They make no apologies. That's not some secret. But you did say they've gotten funding from the state budget in Florida, right, for school-related stuff?
Right. According to the newspapers in Tampa, that they have received $7 million from the state legislature, $7 million the last 2 years, and they had an additional $2 million are pledged this year, and then the governor of Florida, Rick Scott, vetoed it in June. And the lawmakers' argument is that there's huge economic impact in the region of IMG Academy. It, with camps and everything else, it trains 12,000 athletes a year there from the youth level to the pros, and it hosts numerous amateur professional competitions. So the lawmakers feel that the huge economic impact from that area is worth public funding.
And the student-athletes who go to this IMG Academy for football probably have to have some degree of emotional maturity, right, to be away from home in those high school years. I know they're not the first ones to do it, you know, and go to a prep school or something, but this seems a little more rigorous because there's such a emphasis on sports.
Right. Actually, that's the exact term they use, emotional maturity. And, some of the kids have been there since eighth grade. Some came as juniors, and a few, including the top quarterback in the country, are just there for one semester. I mean, he will play football, graduate in December, and then enroll at the University of Mississippi in January. Wow. And, you know, try to compete for the starting quarterback job there. They've got facilities that are far more sophisticated than any other high school I've ever seen. 40,000 square foot field house, 10,000 square foot weight room. Mm. They've got a sports science center for hydration and nutrition, a biomechanics lab, a vision lab to sort of help with the train perceptual and cognitive response, a special hospital for surgery and sports rehab.
Wow.
So their facilities, they would be eye-turning to anybody with the athletic and financial wherewithal to go to school there.
Holy cow. We're speaking with Jeri Longman, sports writer at the New York Times. He's got an interesting piece entitled High School Football, Inc. It's a focus on the IMG Academy. A typical day for these kids is like what, Jeri?
For football, they have breakfast between 6:30 and 7:30. Then they have three classes that last 80 minutes each. They have a tutoring period and a standardized test prep period. Then they have lunch. Then they have training and conditioning from 1:30 to 5:30. Then another hour of tutoring available. Then a mandatory study hall from 7:30 to 9. And then the player said that there's a curfew at 10:30. So it's a long day, and it appears demanding from what I saw. Now the people who were there seem to be happy with it. But, there's also concern around the country. A lot of high school coaches and administrators are looking at this with curiosity and wariness.
Well, it's fascinating. You point out that to sort of, I guess, tamp down some local criticism, IMG Academy does not even recruit football players in Florida, which is one of the nation's absolute hotbeds.
Right. So to be admitted into the Florida High School Athletic Association, they agreed not to recruit inside of Florida. But the Florida Association said that there have been some accusations made by people that IMG is recruiting inside of Florida, but nothing that's been substantiated.
All right, so they say they don't recruit. That doesn't mean a kid from Florida can't just decide to go?
Oh, no, a kid sure can go. And you can also hold open houses, which is a kind of a different thing from out-and-out recruiting. So, no, there are a number of Florida kids who are there.
New York Times reporter Jeri Longman with Gordon Deal. It is now 12 minutes after the hour on this weekend.
You always want to look great, but don't have the time or the patience to go shopping. With Trunk Club, you never have to set foot in the mall again. Trunk Club takes the hassle out of shopping by shipping you a trunk of clothes that fit perfectly and make you look like $1 million with all the new fall styles. At trunkclub.com/morning, all you have to do is answer simple questions about your style, preferences, and size, and then you are assigned an expert stylist. They curate clothes from the best premium brands, and you approve what you like. Just like that, a trunk arrives on your doorstep filled with hand-picked clothes that are perfect for you. Try them on, keep what you like, and easily return what you don't in their prepaid trunk. This is not a subscription service. You only pay for the clothes you keep. No hidden charges, just great clothes. And right now, their entire styling service is free. Even the shipping. You only pay for the clothes you keep. To take advantage, go to trunkclub.com/morning. One more time, that's trunkclub.com/morning for a trunk filled with clothes you'll love wearing.
For the many who are running for the 2016 Republican and Democratic presidential nominations, they're really like CEOs of major corporations. In fact, two of them actually have had that experience in the real world, Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina. But according to tech analyst Rob Enderle, president of the Enderle Group, Trump and Fiorina, along with Hillary Clinton, are demonstrating horrible personal traits that can be company killers in senior management, let alone in the CEO's office. Rob, what are you seeing here?
I got really frustrated, I think, watching both Trump and Clinton, because there are a couple practices that throughout my career have created problems for me in trying to do turnarounds or fixing companies and the rest. And Clinton and Trump were both demonstrating those kinds of behaviors as they ran for office. The first I talk about, of course, is Trump and his inability to acknowledge or take responsibility for mistakes. And the problem with that is if somebody doesn't recognize a mistake, they won't fix it, and they don't take responsibility for a mistake, and they just pass it on to others. It kind of, makes those others feel underappreciated, and they won't be loyal, and the efforts will fail.
So explain how you see that with Trump and Clinton.
With Trump, we certainly saw it with the first debate where he and the Fox reporter kind of got into it on a personal basis. Later on, he does pretty much the same thing with Carly Fiorina, not recognizing that going after a woman from a personal basis, or anybody on a personal basis, It doesn't make you look presidential. It doesn't drive forward your dialectic. It makes you look petty. And we see that going forward he attacked the entire Mexican people on immigration with his now famous line referring to the mullahs, rapists, etc., which also didn't play well. But once again, didn't seem to learn from that, that taking a group, whether it be women or Hispanics or anything, and attacking them broadly like that just takes out an entire voting block. And so the right thing to do is, you don't necessarily have to apologize, but just recognize you've made the mistake and don't remake it. But if you don't recognize it was a mistake, if you think everything you do is absolutely right, and you instead focus on either covering up the mistake or trying to re-spin it so it looks like you did it on purpose and it wasn't a mistake, then you never fix anything. You never grow. You never advance. Whatever your baseline was is what you always have. And especially in a president, that can be incredibly painful.
Let me ask you this. Are politics different because the two you mentioned lead in the polls?
But I think consensus is neither one of them are going to make it to the end. Now, Clinton's problem is very different. Clinton, what came out around Clinton was coverage surrounding her Secretary of State and prior senatorial position, in that she never really seemed to do anything. In fact, thinking back, Obamacare, managed health care, was really Clinton's keystone platform, yet somehow the president had to execute it. But the thing is it looked like she executed a strategy of, let's not do anything, because if I don't really do anything, then nobody's going to criticize me for what I do. And that hiding from criticism, or trying to make sure that there was nothing that she did that would later come back to haunt her, ironically, to a certain extent, has led to her problems at the moment. As people are talking about how great she is and how wonderful she is, they're having a real hard time pointing to actual things she did that were great and wonderful, largely because she seemed to be trying to avoid to do anything that was pronounced. And people like that get in the way of people that want to get stuff done, because typically what they do is that they not only don't do anything, but they don't want anybody else to do anything for fear that they're going to get credit for an accomplishment that they're not going to get. So they can become barriers to accomplishment, and thus the kinds of problems. And if you look at the whole email server thing, clearly also implemented so that she could avoid blame for emails. And then, of course, ironically, she may be responsible for the greatest data breach in the State Department's history.
We're on the phone with tech analyst Rob Enderle. Rob, explain what you mean by the worst traits for leaders.
Well, so what I mean is if you've got a person that won't grow, won't learn from their mistakes, takes credit for everything, passes blame on to other folks, it's very hard to maintain loyalty. I mean, in fact, you look at Trump, the person you really want to feel sorry for is the person that's actually getting stuff done underneath him that is unsung and likely gets blamed for every mistake that occurs. That kind of a behavior just creates a toxic environment where you can't get stuff done, and where the leader kind of stagnates in terms of their overall skill set. They just don't advance. In the Clinton case, if you're spending so much time avoiding blame or avoiding doing something that you get blamed for, what you do is you become this big rock in the path of everybody else, and the company can't move around you. You become a huge impediment to progress. And the funny thing is while Trump's problem can be fixed, he could change his behavior tomorrow and start learning from his mistakes and moving forward. If you've got this long history of not doing anything, you can't go back in time and now start doing stuff. That sticks with you. And so even though I doubt Trump's going to fix his behavior, the fact of the matter is he could, where if Clinton were to change tomorrow and say, you know, if I really want to start doing stuff now, well, she really needed to start doing stuff 4 or 5 years ago so that she'd have that in her portfolio now. And then with respect to the email server, rather than being focused on making sure she covered her own butt and didn't get blamed for any of those emails, maybe being focused a bit more on securing that email might have been a far better strategy, because that was incredibly tactical.
Rob, thanks. That is Rob Enderle, president of the Enderle Group. 25 minutes after the hour, what is new on some college campuses this year besides the latest technology and cutting-edge subjects? How about boxing? Here's Jennifer Kuchinka.
After being discontinued as a varsity sport in 1960, college boxing is making a comeback. Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal has discovered that a diverse group of students are now participating. Rachel, what's sparking the interest in boxing these days?
Well, that's a good question. It's a variety of things. One, we, of course, saw the Mayweather-Pacquiao professional fight get a ton of attention in May. I think that got some more students to come out this fall. But as well, there are more and more young people interested in really intense forms of exercise, and a lot of them are discovering that boxing provides that, and a lot of them are coming out for college boxing teams.
Now, you had mentioned in your story that boxing was kind of banned or discontinued from 1960 on, when did it start making a comeback?
Well, I want to make clear, boxing clubs never went away. It's no longer a varsity sport recognized by the NCAA, but boxing has existed for many years at places like service academies and some other schools around the country. A new governing body, a second governing body for college boxing, surfaced in 2012, the USIBA, and that certainly stirred attention, and one of its goals was to include women in boxing championships and other bouts, and that's another big generator of this sort of new interest in college boxing, is that women are doing it.
Rachel, you mentioned earlier that people are doing this as a form of intense exercise. How many are actually going out and participating in bouts?
That's a great question. It really depends on the place. You know, there's some teams where everybody competes. And, for instance, at University of Michigan, they really want to be a competitive team, and so they have tryouts, and they only accept people who want to fight on the team. At places like, for instance, Iowa State or Penn State, the ratio is much lower. There might be, half to two-thirds to three-fourths of the team that really might not have a whole lot of interest in fighting or don't end up having a bout outside of the school for one reason or another. Some people are concerned about concussions. Other people just might not have the time that it takes to devote to training to really get prepared to safely fight someone else.
In a club sport, are there any restrictions on how many can actually participate?
That again depends on the school. It depends on things like funding and what the goals of the club are. At University of North Carolina, they had more than 250 students come out for the team, so they're pretty much taking all comers. Not all of those people, of course, will fight, and so the people who will fight will get more intensive and more specialized training. But a lot of these students are coming out for these really intensive workouts, and many, many students at North Carolina were drawn for that.
In terms of financing, do the kids have to pay for the equipment themselves, or do they fundraise? How does that work?
They often pay some form of dues, and they typically do get some level of minor funding from, for instance, their college recreation department or their club sports department. So it's usually a combination of the two. They sometimes have to bring their own gloves. It just depends on the place. But these are not varsity sports. These are generally run by the students, organized by students. Many of them have volunteer coaches. So it's a fairly grassroots operation at most places.
Rachel, thank you. That is Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman, along with our own Jennifer Koschinka. And I'm Bruce Johnson. It's 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend with Gordon Deal.
You're results-driven and you're ambitious. You've established yourself professionally, and now you're looking for more. Take the next step in your entrepreneurial journey with Edible Arrangements, the brand that revolutionized gifting with handcrafted fruit arrangements and gourmet chocolate-covered fruit, now also offers delicious everyday treats like smoothies, fruit salads, and parfaits. As an Edible Arrangements franchisee, you get access to an established brand with 16 years of growth, over 80% brand recognition, and 1,200 locations worldwide. You'll benefit from know-how, support, and millions of visitors to the Edible Arrangements e-commerce platform. Discover why Entrepreneur Magazine named Edible Arrangements a top franchise and among their best of the best for 2015. Start your journey to sweet success as an Edible Arrangements franchise owner. Call 1-888-727-4258 or go to edible.com. That's 1-888-727-4258 or edible.com.
Well, I'm sure many of you are among the millions upon millions who have been watching Pope Francis during his first tour of the USA. So you've probably seen all those people traveling with him, a papal entourage, if you will. Well, who are those people? The Washington Post's Dan Zak is now here for a rundown. Dan, talk about the Pope's traveling party.
We found that there was basically a half dozen types of people with him to make his trip smooth and official. You have people who are involved in the papal household. These are the people that help run the papal residence at the Vatican. You have the prefect of the household traveling with him. You also have the masters of ceremony. These are the folks in charge of anything to do with liturgy and public prayer. That goes for wardrobe, that goes for the process of the services themselves. You've got a huge contingent of press. You have the Vatican Press Corps, sometimes referred to as the VAT Pack.
So the members of the papal household, how do they factor into the Pope's everyday dealings?
the person that's with him by his side, besides his interpreter, is often referred to as his valet or his assistant or his butler. And this is the guy who would carry the umbrella for the Pope or kind of take whatever someone gives the Pope from the Pope so the Pope's hands are free.
What about his master of ceremonies? What does that person do?
Essentially in charge of public prayer and liturgical events. So that's kind of anything that involves props, anything that involves vestments, and this changes from pope to pope. It's the master of ceremonies' job to kind of bear out the pope's taste. So, you know, John Paul II preferred colorful liturgies, and so the liturgies, the vestments, and kind of the pageantry of the liturgy reflected that. Benedict XVI was more austere and traditional in his preferences, and of course Pope Francis has very simple tastes all around. So you'll notice a change in wardrobe for Monsignors between Benedict and Francis. They were more ornate during Benedict's time, and now it's more simple lace for vestments.
We're talking to Washington Post reporter Dan Zak. Dan, of course, we have to talk about the security detail. What did you find out there?
Well, you've got a combination. You've got a combination of the Pope's security team from Italy, that's Vatican City Police, the Swiss Guard, which has protected the Pope since the year 1506, and they collaborate with local jurisdictions, namely in this case, the Secret Service. But, you know, just being at the parade route with Francis, you not only had the Secret Service, you had Park Police, U.S. Park Service, you had people from Homeland Security, you had people from Border Patrol and Customs, and you had TSA agents screening people. So it's an enormous collaboration between various security jurisdictions.
Who is, as you point out, the one lucky staffer?
Francis has developed a habit of, for every trip he makes out of the Vatican, or out of Italy, I should say, he picks one layman or laywoman from the Vatican staff to join the trip. Someone who otherwise would not serve a purpose on the trip, he kind of just does it essentially to be a good boss, not to make light of it. But in this case, he chose a woman named Valentina Ambrosi, and she's an artist in the Vatican's mosaic studio. So she is kind of the lucky Vatican staffer to accompany the Pope on his trip to Cuba and the U.S.
Dan, thanks. That is Washington Post reporter Dan Zak. It is now 21 minutes in front of the hour on this weekend. I'm Bruce Johnson, sitting in for Gordon, who's taking the weekend off. New York is one of many cities nationwide which wants to be a living lab for smart city technologies, working with companies to build systems that save residents and the city money while improving efficiency, safety, and sustainability. To that end, New York already has saved building owners millions of dollars by attaching leak-detecting sensors to water meters and used hospital data on drug overdoses to search for drug rings. Jennifer Booten of MarketWatch has written about this growing trend nationwide. Jennifer, what have you found out?
A lot of cities are investing in technology in ways that they've never had before, and most of that is working with major Silicon Valley technology companies such as IBM or Siemens, Microsoft, to implement these new technologies in an effort to make better decisions and predictions about the flows of their cities and improve life for their residents and save money.
So what kind of flows are we talking about?
So what's anchoring much of this right now are sensors. So they're working with these companies to put sensors pretty much all over the city, from pipes that are managing the quality of water to putting them on city buses so that streetlights can change as buses approach. They're doing all of this to make the city more efficient, and that includes from the water that flows through its pipe to the waste that is removed from the city to how people live and get around.
Which cities are doing what? What jumps out here?
This is something that's long been occurring overseas in places like South Korea and the Netherlands, Spain, even in Barcelona, but the U.S. is just starting to really back the movement. And some of the main cities that are working on this is New York is one of the main ones. They have, they're the ones that have adopted that city bus sensor, and all of a sudden the lights change green as the bus approaches. They also have a water quality sensor on their water pipes that let them know immediately when there's a contaminant in the water. Other cities, such as in San Francisco, they're working on creating a giant system of connectivity between software programs and apps and security cameras that for the Super Bowl that they're hosting in February, everyone will be able, from the National Football League to transportation authorities to police, will all be able to monitor everything in real time and be able to react if there's any kind of issues. Cleveland has also taken to a surveillance program similar to that. Since 2007, they've been pulling data from both public and private cameras, and that's been credited with a decline in crime rates there.
We're chatting with Jennifer Booten for MarketWatch. Jennifer, where's the money coming from?
Yeah, it's a newly appropriated. The thing is, they are working with them and kind of pitching this idea that they can work to create the or implement these more efficient systems that they're going to save money. And actually, in some sense, it could be cheaper because instead of, for example, widening a road and having this massive infrastructure project, they can put these sensors and hook these cameras up together and actually just make the traffic flow a little bit quicker. Or, you know, put bike sharing programs all over their cities. So New York has been really big with City Bike, and the idea is that takes people off of public transportation a little bit or off the streets and makes just everything more efficient.
You mentioned some countries before, South Korea, Barcelona, the Netherlands. Are they ahead of us? Have we been playing catch up?
Everybody that I spoke to who's intimate in this industry says that we are playing catch up. I think that they've just been more quick to invest in it, but it is a lot of the same technologies that we're talking about. I know that in South Korea they have a whole wall that's just a giant touch screen that you can go into and shop while you're waiting for the subway. It's just crazy things like that. For the most part, it's sensors and making their public transportation more efficient.
Jennifer, thanks. That is MarketWatch's Jennifer Booten. It is now 14 minutes in front of the hour on this weekend.
While most video surveillance solutions capture and store hours of nothing, CUDA Eye by Barracuda Networks only captures video when something happens. Once captured on camera, the video evidence is immediately encrypted and sent to the cloud for safe storage and easy retrieval from any web browser or mobile device. With CUDA Eye, there's no network configuration or software to install. Just plug one or more cameras into your network to better protect your business. Don't get caught with nothing. Do something about it. Check out CUDAEye.com. That's CUDAEye.com.
For a lot of parents, helping with their children's homework in the brave new academic world of 2015 can often be a brain freeze, particularly when it comes to the Science Fair project. Gordon, who is a parent of two, has more empathetically.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. Her piece is called How to Survive the School Science Fair. All right, so here we are back in school, Sue. Piece this together.
Well, soon these assignments are going to start arriving home. The School Science Fair project, and for many parents, it's such an annual nightmare. It's kind of like homework on steroids. It's like kids have to come up with an idea, complete a project, do experiments, write it up, get ready to present it. And many parents, even if the kids do the science part, find they're helping out an awful lot.
Oh, that is true. Guilty right here. Guilty.
Yeah, same here.
Oh, it's funny because I think the science fair at my daughter's middle school, you just have to submit something. It's not necessarily for grade, but you have to submit something. So.
Right. That's often the case, and it's happening at younger grades. Many schools are starting to open them up to kindergartners or pre-kindergartners to come in with a little question or project. So, yeah, not always a full-blown experiment, but some kind of a little item they offer.
Yeah, I can remember saying, she finished, and then it was more like with my wife, well, we finished, technically, we finished, right? Specify.
Exactly, right.
So, what do you do? Because, kids are busier than ever, right, than when you and I were in school, for example. They got a million things to do in the afternoon, and sometimes you're relieved. You're like, great, we got 3 weeks' notice. But 20 days later, we realized we haven't put it together.
We haven't started yet. That's the problem. It's really, some parents I spoke to actually set aside weekend time just so a child could concentrate and pull together, the data or whatever they're working on. And one of the biggest things parents have to do is to keep the kid on track and set milestones so we'll get this part done by this time and so on. And otherwise, kids really very seldom have the time management skills at these ages to do that.
All right, so what do you do? Because you can't really you don't want to badmouth the teacher or the school, right? And say like, oh, you got to be kidding. It's going to ruin our family right. time or soccer or game or something like that.
Yeah,
what do you do?
Say, I hate science.
Yes,
why do
right.
we? Right. Not the right response. The whole point of this exercise, teachers and experts told me, is to kindle kids' interest in science. We all know that the world is, you know, it's more important every day to know science and engineering. So even if a parent hates science, try to kind of spark your own curiosity or your child's curiosity. The best place to start is if you notice your child being curious about something around them, you know, apple juice, calories, and start from there. Try to enjoy it as an exploration with your child and put aside any feelings you might have about it.
Mm. We're speaking with Wall Street Journal columnist Sue Schellenbarger. She's got a piece entitled How to Survive the School Science Fair. All right, so we have to do a little revisiting of history here. The best one or the one that stands out in your mind that you helped your kids with.
Oh, this is a good one. I think I could give you the worst one.
Do it, yeah, the worst
one. The volcano, the bubbly volcano with vinegar and baking soda is not even a science project. You know, the teacher said, you know, that's really a demonstration.
Right.
You know, you're not really experimenting with anything there. One of my favorites from my reporting was where a girl was inspired by the family dog who kept rolling in smelly things to do a project on how to remove skunk odor.
Mm.
And she actually came up with a successful formula for removing skunk odor, which all her neighbors were taking notes on the night of the science fair. So you can really have some fun with this.
Wall Street Journal reporter Sue Schellenbarger with our own Gordon Deal on how to help your child's science fair project. I always told my kids to drop some Mentos into a bottle of Coke, but that's me. Pope Francis is wrapping up his first U.S. tour this weekend in Philadelphia. Now, you probably won't be one of the few souls to meet him face to face, but hey, it could happen. And if it does, don't you want to be ready? So for our friends in Philly, here's a primer on what you need to know, so at the very least, you'll be well prepared for small talk about him, if not to him. All right. When you speak to the Pope, address him as Your Holiness. As for his ring, if you're not Catholic, there is no expectation whatsoever that you kiss it. And even if you are Catholic, it's not required. Give the Pope a handshake instead. Pope Francis is trilingual. He speaks fluid Spanish, plus a bit of English, French, and Portuguese, so pick a language. You can't go wrong. What shouldn't you bring up? Television. The Pope says he has not watched TV in 25 years, and nothing on pets. Francis scolded married couples a year ago for raising pets instead of having children. And if you want to compliment him on his clothing, his robe is a white cassock, his cape is a pellegrina, his white sash-like belt is a fascia. There you have it. All you need to know if you meet Pope Francis face-to-face in Philly this weekend. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Kashinka, I'm Bruce Johnson, filling in for Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend.
Your to-do list can seem out of control with so much to do and so little time. Fortunately for you, there's one thing you can check off your to-do list, and that's going to the post office, thanks to my friends at Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your own computer and printer. Stamps.com will send you a digital scale that automatically calculates the exact postage you need for any letter or package on any class of mail. You'll never waste valuable time going to the post office again. Do everything right from your desk with Stamps.com. Right now, use my last name, Deal, for this special offer. 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes the digital scale and up to $55 free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in Deal. That's Stamps.com. Enter Deal.